Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. This is your host Rika Anna Horvath, and today we are talking to Christian Hansel about his book Memory Makes the Brain. It was published by Bird Scientific in 2021, and Christian is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Chicago. Christian, welcome to the show and thanks a lot for this cool book. Can you please start by introducing yourself?
Well, thanks, Rika, for having me. That's a wonderful opportunity. As you said, I'm at the University of Chicago for a while now. I started out as a zoologist studied in Germany and then in Switzerland. And you know, it goes with scientists. You're all over the place. You're kind of seeing different institutions and places. I was for my doctorate program at the Max Planck Institute in Frankfurt. I was in America for my postdoctoral studies at Johns Hopkins University. And I actually had the first lab of my own in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam. And then after about 8 years there, I came here to the University of Chicago. And I do study learning at the level of cellular mechanisms. How do circuits in the brain learn? What makes brains so special in terms of how they adapt so wonderfully to needs in the environment and to changes that request like adaptations in the brain? Cellular mechanisms mostly. One of the focus areas is the cerebellum. That's the brain area in the back of the brain that's largely or traditionally considered to be important for motor programming and motor adaptations, but not exclusively. Maybe we are getting to that. But also somewhat in the neocortex, we study those mechanisms. And all that has led me to the book and what is summarized and introduced there. And for some years, we are also interested in clinical applications of these interests, like in particular autism. And that is also part of the book, like how do... So we surely get to that too later, but autism is not a learning disorder per se, but processes that are involved in these brain plasticity processes are also wrong in autism, and that is what we study too in the lab.
Thank you. That's a great introduction. And I would like to continue with a probably bit difficult task, because at the very beginning of the book, you have an amazing figure involving a story about a butterfly, and then afterwards, how the episode becomes this butterfly. And the later chapters reference back again and again to this figures you point on, and I encourage the listeners to check it out. But now I would like to ask you to describe it with the audio a bit.
Yeah, so the question is, what is really a memory, right? And a lot of people would start out saying memory is in what we can do. It's defined by behaviors. So a learned behavior, you can do something better or worse afterwards. And of course, in our daily lives, it makes sense too, because we learn to do specific movements in sports. We learn to play music instruments. We learn to do things better. And actually, that focus also in research on behavioral learning comes from psychology, and that is also described in the book. That is actually a movement that started out with Skinner and the famous Skinner books. And this Skinner person, he was very much into something that was not, that is a thought that is very important. And he was saying, you know, we need to experimentally verify what we want to prove, right? And so he wanted to push this idea, we have to get away from just philosophical ideas and thinking about the brain. We need to basically experimentally verify things, and everything else is kind of not so valid. And so that led to this emphasis on experiments and measures in behavior with animal models. And that was then applied to learning and memory too. So saying like learning and memory is behaviorally tested, like in diverse learning tests. And that is what that is. And then that notion got a little bit of life of its own, like saying, yeah, you know, learning is when we can do something better or we do something. And in this book, that is a lot what my argument here is. That is not wrong, but it's only half of the story. Because also memory is what happens in the brain, and that doesn't immediately lead to a measurable outcome. So think about when you are learning a poem or something. Of course, you can be asked to recite that poem, and you know, but it can also be just stuck in your head, and it's in your brain. And so I think it also is a fascinating idea to see the brain at first as a tissue, like an organ, like other organs in our bodies, and see how does the substance change when we acquire information. And that thought and everything that follows with that is getting entirely lost if you focus exclusively on learned behavior. And so this introductory characterization and discussion of memory tries to get a little bit away from the behavior and is saying what is really memory. And so if you have a memory of that kind, so you are seeing something, and of course it can be anything, right? You are seeing something like a butterfly, and there was just a memory that anybody can have, but it just occurred to me as a good example from my own childhood. You are on a walk with your family, you are seeing something unusual, a butterfly on a stone, and you memorize that, and then you walk away, and the butterfly flies away, and you memorize that potentially years after, decades after, if it's important enough to you. The butterfly is long dead. And so that scene is not there anymore, but you do remember it, and there's no behavior involved really, but something. And that's really one of the mysteries in our brains, right? So something in that tissue, in that bland tissue, makes it possible that we remember that, right? And what it is basically we have first in perception this complicated, that's already complicated enough, right? So we have this whole sequence of things in sensory perception going on there. And then finally, we can get the same or similar, of course, in our mind's eye recall of that information. We see a butterfly, of course, not visually, but we imagine it. And so that means somehow it's stored by a single neuron or a network of neurons. And that needs that or similar. It can also be that storage place is moved or changes over time. And that needs to be then reactivated to make it happen. And you imagine that butterfly now, right? And so as a behavior, I'm speaking a little bit against the behavioral measure, and I'm using the same word. But as an outcome, that seems so simple. And yet that is so complicated that is possible, right? And it's a representation. It's a representation in the part of our brain, either in a network or sometimes even potentially in a single neuron. And how that happens, that is, of course, subject to very intense studies in the entire neuroscience community by many, many laboratories, including my own.
Thank you. This was a great description both of the various aspects of memory and of this first distinction. So I encourage everyone to check out this figure, which shows really well that both says might be evolved during perception, and but subset of this says again evolved during memory recall, although the butterfly isn't present anymore. And regarding that, is it fair to say that memory is any kind of event that leads to some changes in the structure of the brain or of the nervous system, so to say? And this kind of learned behavior, when some skill is improved thanks to this change, that is more a kind of second level outcome of it, so to say. Is that a kind of correct way to phrase it?
It is correct, but at the same time is also incredibly complicated. And what I mean by that is that, of course, the idea that there would be large and really prominent changes in brain structure with learning or with acquiring knowledge or even with intelligence or something, right? So that at a larger scale of brain structure is not the case. And there are very, very interesting examples of how in the past people thought that would be the case, and they would try to prove that and failed horribly. Like you might know that, like when Lenin died, for example, right? That was in, was that 1918 or something? I can be wrong. Then the Soviets at the time, they tried to prove like how brilliant he was and how much of a great brain he had. And they tried to convince the best neuroanatomist of the time, Oskar Vogt in Germany, to examine the brain of Lenin and to show like that there was some structural change because of that intelligence, for example, right? And Vogt was a smart man, and I'm not sure, it's not entirely clear, at least not to me, whether he believed in that enterprise or not. But he said, yeah, you just build me an institute and give me all the infrastructure and stuff, and then I examine that for you. And that happened indeed. And he analyzed Lenin's brain, and he made some claims about pyramidal neurons being a little bit bigger and stuff. And then later analysis showed that Lenin's brain, and he was without any doubt, of course, he was an intelligent man, but it turned out it was in horrible shape because he suffered several strokes in his life, right? So, and nothing of that was really, of course, holding up. So in a similar story with Einstein's brain, he died in 1955. That's a pretty famous story too, and a local pathologist in Princeton, where he died, tried to prove like that he was so intelligent and how that would happen and how his brain would be bigger and something. And then after some time of not really finding somebody to do the proper analysis, and even stealing the brain and living in trailer parks with the FBI following him, that's a really wild story but true. It turns out that Einstein's brain was smaller than average, which again shows that the overall volume doesn't really matter, the weight doesn't really matter, these kind of things. This overall structure is not really the critical parameter, because, of course, there's no point to debate that he was highly intelligent. So that is not really what we are looking for anymore at that level. So a lot of learning and acquirement, and of course intelligence is not acquiring things, but it's a little bit going the same direction here, is not about gross structure. And yet this notion that there is a structural change is not entirely wrong. And so I discuss also in the book, there was early on, at the time of the First World War, there was this really interesting figure in Germany, Richard Seemann. And he turned, coined the term engram, the memory engram. And he was really, really interested in this phenomenon without knowing anything about modern neuroscience, of course. But he was very, very interested in that experience would change, would somehow engrave, there would be an engraving of that experience in the brain. And he wasn't thinking about like large superscale changes, but just like some whatever level it is, right? And so the question is, in nowadays understanding and nowadays modern understanding of learning and memory, where it's really more about transmitter receptors at the synapses, these connection sites between neurons, and transmitters for glutamate, which is the main communicative transmitter between neurons. These receptors change in their density, in their properties. Can we find any equivalent of this engraving at the substrate level? And it's a little bit, you know, you have it depends a little bit on how far you are willing to go yourself with the terminology and the interpretation. But in a way, you can say yes, because you can change for on a long-term basis the density, for example, of these receptors, and that is in a way a morphological parameter too. So a physiological parameter becomes a morphological parameter, and then also on the dendrites, these reception antennas of the neurons to receive these synapses, there are these little protrusions, the spines, the so-called spines, right, where excitatory synapses go. And in learning and in strengthening of synaptic weights, those can be growing, they can be changing, and even new ones can arise, and they can last then for long times. Although there might be some turnover, but still they last for some time. And so if you want to, you can see those as a substrate change and an engraving. And that leads you to an interesting perspective where you really have then a learning effect, a memory effect on the substrate of the brain. That is quite interesting. And in the context of what we will discuss here, that becomes then quite substantial and essential, actually.
There was one important term which occurred in your description and which occurs many times in the book, of course, synapse. Can you perhaps define it?
Yeah, so a synapse is, there are different types, but it just means a contact between these different individual neurons, these cell types in the brain that that allow for communication in the brain. These are the contact sites, and there are the various types. You can have a direct contact, like their membranes can be merged and an electrical signal can directly go from one to the other. That would be like in the heart muscle or so. That is more the exception, but it's also the case. It takes place too, but more typically we have chemical synapses. So it means there's a real spatial separation between the two, and then one electrical signal in one neuron 2 leads to a release of a chemical transmitter, a binding of the transmitter to a receptor on the target neuron, and then that leads to a generation of a new electrical signal. And those can be excitatory, so they can be activating the target neuron. In some cases, they can also be inhibitory, or deactivating it. Overall, there are more of these activating ones. For example, in the neocortex, the inhibitory neurons are about, so I'm talking about the neurons now per se, not the synapses. The inhibitory neurons are about 15 to 20%. It just gives you an idea. The rest is excitatory neurons. But still, so yeah, there are different types. And these contacts on the spines we mentioned before, these specializations in the dendrite, that is largely excitatory synapses. And both can show actually this type of plasticity. So plasticity would be a change that is activity, that is experience dependent in a context of learning, and that would last at least for a while, maybe even quite a while. Yeah.
Continue with these changes, Nicole. In the third chapter, you are describing what kind of changes can happen, let's say, around the synapse, both in the presynaptic neuron, which releases some neurotransmitter, and also in the at the other end, at the postsynaptic neuron.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we have, it can go both ways, and that's the interesting thing, right? So so one important thing here is the majority of those synapses, let's talk about the excitatory ones, most of them are designed so that it's not a very reliable transmission. And that is a trick of the brain. So it's not like in the heart muscle where you reliably get this a cascade of events that always leads to the heartbeat. But most of the time, it is what we call sub-threshold. And so that means it doesn't work quite right. So it's not working efficiently. Now you might ask, if you're not in that field, you might ask, well, that doesn't seem like very efficient. But that is actually exactly the basis for modulation, because you don't want the brain that is overwhelmed all the time. Because think about it, we have billions of these synapses. If all of them would be efficiently activated all the time, you would be just sitting in your chair and you couldn't do anything at all. You need a very, very selective activation. There are only a very small number of those synapses does something efficiently. And then you want to be able to modulate those. So only some of them, and only in cooperation typically, so some need to be active together, some neurons to activate a target neuron. And then you need, in addition, some sort of plasticity, so meaning a potentiation, for example, a long-term potentiation that's called LTP, long-term potentiation, to then make it more efficient so that then this network, because it turned out to be useful, is then activated efficiently, and that pathway does something good for you now, and you want that more often, more likely, more easily activated. But then we also have the situation where the opposite happens. If use is not very efficient, you can have activity-dependent depression. That's long-term depression, LTD. And then it's also an activity-dependent process. It's not passive, really. And then you can rebuild or diminish again the strength of those synapses. So it's a very, very, very modulated and flexible process in the brain. So the brain adapts all the time. And basically, with all the experience you have any minute in your brain, these things are pushed forward. And depending on the importance of the signals you are getting, they make these long-lasting changes or more transient changes, but there's something all the time. And so that is also what is really important to realize here. So memory or this change of the brain, and that's also the title of the brain, Memory Makes the Brain, is really history of experience makes the brain in a way, right? So memory reflects a history, maybe a cumulative history of experiences that you have, right? And that's only one perspective, of course, on memory. The same as behavioral outcomes, only one perspective on memory. Yeah, they are not wrong, but it's different ways to see it, right? And so if it's a cumulative history of the brain, that means all these little pushes you get and all these little, maybe that's not a wrong term, like little pushes for different parts of the nervous system to engage or disengage and to do something and to activate and to change, that defines then where you stand with your brain. And to give you an idea why that is important, and that is very early in the book too, it was discovered at the University of Chicago by a person called Peter Hottenlocher. That was actually a quite dramatic discoverer. Imagine this. So you know how human babies and babies of other animals are born with these enormous heads, right? So that means they have already quite something going on in their brain there. There's something going on that's bigger than the rest of their bodies, right? So and it turns out now the density and total number of these synapses that we talked about grows very rapidly after birth. For about a year. And that is not unexpected, right? You would think, sure, yeah, no, they are not doing much at first, and they have to get better, right? And so that's not unexpected. But now the unexpected is happening. And that is that from this 1 year post-birth period onwards to about 7 years, after birth, there is a reduction in these synapses by about 50%. So the brain spends all this activity and energy in kicking all these synapses out again. And that is an activity-dependent competitive process called pruning. And the purpose of that has to do with finding out which ones are best adapted to your experiences and just optimizing your brain circuits for your environment. So genetically, of course, you know, we are born as a certain species, a member of a certain species. So the way our brains look like, the way we look like is already pre-given in a way. But now you have to fine-tune that. And that is happening in this pruning. So it's a competitive process. The best synapses connection survives. The other ones do not survive. And that shows that is also very similar to adult plasticity. It's the same molecular processes happening, but it's the amplitude and the probability is much bigger in these early childhood years because you have to disconnect, you have to connect, you have to stabilize, emphasize, disconnect, and so on and so forth. So it's a pretty brutal fight for survival going on there. And that is learning too, because the brain learns to adjust its circuits. And if you just look at this phenomenon, you also understand why it's so important to have an additional look at learning that is not only behavior, but also this brain substance, because this early childhood learning and this pruning, that is the best example for how you see the substrate of the brain, the circuits change on their own. Without an immediate, of course, it's all reflected in behavioral outcomes, but you can't directly and specifically test that easily, right? And this shows the importance of this view. The substance, the substrate changes drastically. And all that has a consequence then for the formation of the brain. It can go wrong in certain diseases, including autism. And so it's a very dramatic and super important process in brain development.
Thank you. That's indeed a great example, because here we can observe some really big behavioral changes and a lot of skills learned in this period. And it's really interesting to know what kind of brain substance and structure changes can be observed at the same time. And in the book, you also elaborate on the connection between the synaptic pruning mechanism, which takes place mainly in childhood, and long-term depression, which is, in the sense of long-term depressing of the synaptic connection, which takes place practically over the whole lifetime. Can you describe how these two are similar and in which way they are different?
So the balance between the potentiation and depression goes on throughout all stages of life, right? Importance or their relevance, if you want, changes in the different periods of life. At first, in this first year that I talked about, you do need to build up that network. So there's a lot of potentiation, stabilization of synapses going on. Then in pruning, there's a lot of depression going on. But still, the networks are reforming. So it means you need stabilization in other places too. It's never just one or the other, right? And in adult learning, both of these processes are kind of more in a balance, but both still do exist at the same time too. And both continue even in the adult, and that was not known until more recently, that the depression can even result in complete disconnection of synapses. So it is way harder. So the plasticity is way bigger in these early years. There's also a term for that. It's called the critical period, where the plasticity is much more dramatic. And afterwards it's less dramatic, but you continue these processes, you continue potentiation and depression until you die pretty much. Even if you have Alzheimer's and you are in some old people's home, you are still, the plasticity is still present, but it's changed. It's less easy to activate it. It's less easy to trigger it. And this critical period describes this time frame of heightened plasticity that has to do also with inhibitory circuits. It has to do with availability of this open window, this gate for these large dramatic changes. And the duration changes with the different species. The shorter the lifetime of a different animal is, the shorter it can be. So in rodents, for example, which is one of the most used model animal in research, it's 3 weeks. And in cats, it's several months. And then in macaques, for example, it can be then 1 or 2 years or something, you know. So and then in humans, it's up to school year pretty much. Of course, there's influences too. And Huttenlocher, that the person that discovered pruning that I mentioned before, he was also seeing the relevance of this. He was making the point, okay, so if our learning, our plasticity is so much bigger in this time period, that also means we have to use it in education, and in we have to make use of that in school, to which is known, of course, generally, but that gives the scientific basis for that, that we, even when you want to your child to learn a music instrument or something, then you have to start very early on. That's because of this critical period in the brain circuits, right? And that's also why if you get really serious in some sports, you know, in pretty much any kind of sports, you need to start pretty much early on. And that has to do with these larger degrees of plasticity that are present in these early childhood periods.
You also mentioned that the length of this critical period is not just depending on the species of the animal, but it might can be also different between different brain areas.
Yes. Yeah. There are some differences there too. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. It's not an overly extreme effect, but yes. Yeah. There are some small effects too.
And what about the potentiation depression ratio in later stages of life? Because you mentioned that both phenomena are present all the time, but its potentiation plays a much higher role. Are there any, so to say, more detailed data about that? Are there some specific brain areas or circuits where depression can be present even in a later stage, or do we know what it depends on?
You do have both, and the degree of plasticity in both of these processes is getting reduced in all of these brain areas. But there are some circuits where depression plays a bigger role per se. That actually has to do with the circuit layout. So in cortical structures, a lot works with reciprocal excitation. So that means in the cortex, in the neocortex and cortical areas, neurons activate themselves, they activate their neighbors, they activate attached areas via excitatory synapses. So a potentiation of these synapses leads to just a strengthening of whatever that circuit does. So it's pretty intuitively clear. There are also circuits, though, where you need to disinhibit and you really need to remove a brake. That is the case in the cerebellum. That is the case in the basal ganglia partially. And then long-term depression becomes an important learning mechanism, and potentiation is almost the reversal of that. You remove inhibition, you remove a brake on an otherwise excitatory circuit. That is also a motif that is present here. And that also shows we cannot just go, there's not a model setup per se, there's not a model circuit per se that works. And that makes it so difficult. We cannot just have a pharmaceutical approach and boost learning by a drug that's systematically administered, and you would expect that it's working perfectly well for everything you do, because it might have a beneficial effect on one type of learning, but then it doesn't really give you a benefit on another. It might actually harm you. You see, that's a problem.
Yeah, that makes absolutely sense. And you have mentioned that the cerebellum is quite different in the for example, from the cortex, partly because Purkinje cells have this inhibitory output. Mm-hmm. And can you explain more these both the similarities and the differences between LTP and LTD in the cortex and in the cerebellum?
Yes, so the cerebellum is a very, very specific area that way. It's evolutionary very, very old, way before the cortex arrived, the six-layered cortex in mammals. We had like precursors at the time in other vertebrate animals that have three layers and simple layered structures, but the cerebellum is already present in those animals too. And it has some, just to start with that, it has some function in integration of sensory inputs, making use of that for motor control, but presumably also for non-motor functions. One very interesting, unique feature of that is the type of synapses that are integrated in the cerebellar. It has a cortex structure to the cerebellar cortex. And the principal type of neuron is called the Purkinje cell after a Czech anatomist at the time, Jan Purkinje. These Purkinje cells integrate a lot of information about the state of our body via proprioceptors and about the sensory environment, informs the organism, our body, about the state of all the sensory systems. And this information is used for motor integration, keeping balance, for example, and those kind of reaching movements, gain of movements, but also non-motor things. One very specific thing is we have an arrow signal mechanism here. There's a so-called climbing fiber that's originating from a brainstem structure, the so-called inferior olive. And there's one or more climbing fibers, one or a few more, depending on the dendrite structure and the species, on the Purkinje cell. And that is activated when something goes wrong in your sensory motor world. So something is not as expected. The cerebellum integrates what is expected. So for example, when I said before, like you collect all these myriads of information about sensory information, where your body is standing, what is happening, and so on and so forth. But now if you are doing something yourself, like you are turning around or so, then you are experience a different sensory world, right? And it totally makes sense, of course, if with that motor action, you are already informing yourself, the brain, your brain is already informing your brain's circuits that you did that and you have to expect a different sensory income now, input. And that is part of what the cerebellum does. But now, so it forms predictions. But now if something goes wrong and not according to plan, you get a different sensory feedback that is not as predicted, for example, then these climbing fibers are active and it forces the entire circuit in the cerebellum into a learning situation, into this plasticity situation. It happens via calcium signaling, via big depolarization. And it leads ultimately to an adaptation of motor gain. So, for example, you did that turn, you expected some sensory input going a certain direction, but maybe the mistake was made because the motor degree, the amplitude of your movement was a little off. It was too much or too little, and then your expectation signal was off. And now that learning scenario would force you to show some sort of a gain control, some plasticity there, so that your gain, the amplitude of that movement, is up or down regulated. And that is what that learning in that cerebellar circuit does. And it works via these, we can't really put all the puzzle pieces together now in this podcast, but that works via this change in this brake mechanism on these brainstem mechanisms. The output of the cerebellar cortex is changed changes this brake mechanism, and that works in this particular case via this long-term depression. So it's a very, very interesting circuit, but it works quite differently from neocortical circuits.
That's very interesting. So it means that the input from these climbing fibers is necessary to have to reach the threshold, which then causes both an LTP or an LTD. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, and that is a threshold for a calcium signal. So, at these synapses, at these excitatory synapses, the activation of the synapses, the depolarization that happens there, is transferred into a calcium influx signal. And both the depression and the potentiation mechanisms are calcium dependent. And that sounds like a problematic design, but it does work via an amplitude threshold. So one is reached, triggers the one process. And if a lower one or a higher one in this case is reached, triggers the opposite mechanism, right? And then that decides this bidirectionality of the plasticity processes at the synapses. Yeah.
And in the special case of the cerebellum, this kind of threshold is most of the time reached if there is a gap between the expected sensory input and the real sensory input, so to say. And that's what leads to changes in the neuroreceptors, and that's why the behavioral change, which we can observe afterwards, is the fine-tuning of the movement.
That yes.
Next time I turn a little bit more or a little bit less, because
Yes, and the importance of so that seems almost like a small, very specialized part of brain function in a way. It is not, because these input neurons that provide the information about sensory environment to the cerebellar cortex make up something between 50% and 80% of all neurons in the entire brain. So this input is super dense that goes to the cerebellar cortex. A lot of energy goes into that, and that shows it's really this integration center. And what the cortex does in contrast, it and the information is preserved for a long time. It's in its original state, it's preserved at the level of these Purkinje cells that I mentioned before, that are the main projection neurons in the cerebellar cortex. The information can be brought together between different types of inputs. That is the center for associative learning in the brain. So where when a stimulus A and a stimulus B is to be associated with one another, or a temporal sequence is associated to one another. For example, when you have your coffee mug and you associate the coffee, the taste, and the mug with one another, then you need a brain center doing that, and that is what the cerebellum does. That is not to say that neocortex can't do that at all, but the cerebellum is older and it could do that to start with. And the temporal sequence, you reach out your hand, is step one. You get the coffee mug, you drink, you have that experience, a sensory sensation. All these things that appear so normal to us still need to be processed in the brain, right? And that is what the cerebellum does. And it does way more too, for example, in motor and non-motor aspects of language. It's also important. And the reason is presumably it has to do with time processing. So temporal sequences and event action. So temporal sequences and sensory events, how they fall into a temporal sequence, that is also what the cerebellum does. So there's already getting quite interesting. And associative learning is also important in language. Think about words and their symbolic meaning, right? We have a word for everything, and then it has a symbol that means something. And all these kind of things is presumably what the cerebellum is involved in. We know that from studies from patients with cerebellar damage who are having damages and who are having impairments in those functions, right? And that shows why that is important too, and why this plasticity in learning processes in those areas are important too, not just in the neocortex. So we have to study all these changes that we initially talked about, like these density of receptor changes and the rules that are applying in certain circuits in the normal healthy brain, and then getting to autism. All these changes in these different contexts throughout these different brain circuits to get a full understanding of what is going on.
That's intriguing also because you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that the cerebellum was for a long time regarded as something which is so responsible for motor behavior, so to say, and motor fine-tuning. And now it has turned out that it has much a much bigger repertoire, so to say. Can you perhaps talk a bit more about that? What do we mean by these temporary sequences? What kind of processes are involved there?
So a lot of the cerebellar function, what exactly it does, is still being investigated now. Right now, there's just this paradigm change. So, right, the researchers are understanding now something is not quite right the way we looked at the cerebellum before. And of course, that evidence was coming from clinical observations that mostly cerebellar patients with a tumor or with something happening there, genetic deficits in ataxias or so, have motor deficits. But that does not mean that that is a primary function, right? It could also be, like I was suggesting, it can also be integrating sensory information in an interesting way that is used partially to generate meaningful motor output. Then you measure deficits in the motor output, but that is only part of what it really does, right? So that is always, and that is this paradigm change that we are having right now. The timing structure, that is also observations that you can look at cerebellar patients and make observations about behaviors that require timing, like, for example, throwing a ball. And then you see that they can throw a ball, they can walk, but the temporal aspect, the kinetics, is not quite right. That is the one thing. Then we also see in the structure of it, there are elements in the anatomy that make us think that the processing has to do with timing too. Information that's coming in by these neurons that are 50 to 80% of the entire brain neurons that I mentioned before is going along, and I say that in quotation marks now, a cable line that goes in the human brain by several millimeters from one Purkinje cell to the next. They are perpendicularly oriented. And that means this information is passing these Purkinje cells so that from one end to the other end, about 15 milliseconds are passing. And that allows you now to say, okay, so we don't really know exactly what that means, but candidates are that is a mechanism even for the brain to understand that time was passing and progressing per se. Right? And that seems something also where you would think, why do we even need that? Why would, but there's not really a brain center for time perception per se. Of course, when an event, a sensory event or something you do happens, and then another one after a second or so, sure, then we have, you know, our cognitive abilities allow us to tell that apart. But it's a level of milliseconds, tens of milliseconds or so, we don't have that, but might still be required and informative. And that is something that very likely the cerebellum is able to do via these sensory information cables. They're called the parallel fibers. That is a second excitatory input next to the climbing fibers. And they are actually these learning sites where the long-term depression and potentiation occur, but they are instructed by the climbing fiber. And the way they are arranged in this perpendicular way to the Purkinje cells, that allows a little bit for perception of passage of time in this range of tens of milliseconds. So that could give a mechanism for bringing things together, like bringing things together about the passage of time, bringing things together about sensory inputs that are associated with one another at the same time or in a sequence of time, because association can also mean one thing is happening after another one, right? As a consequence of another one. A is a predictor of B. So those kind of things, right? And now we will get to autism, but think about it. It seems so a lot of new evidence for a while speaks toward that very unexpectedly, but that is now some 20 years or so we have accumulating evidence that very unexpectedly the cerebellum is a very heavy player in autism. And that is a surprise because at the time when people saw it as a motor device, autism is not primarily a motor problem. Of course, there are motor problems with it quite often, but it's not primarily a motor problem. It's not a motor disease. It's a cognitive disease or disorder, however you want to call it, dysfunction. And yet, the cerebellum is a big contributor, and now this starts to bring things together. So associations, A with B, very, very quick associations, temporal sequences, language composition, all that starts making sense because there's often language impairment. There's impairment in non-motor functions of language, like finding, placing words in the right grammatic order and finding the right words is often impaired in autism. And so things start falling into place, understanding why the cerebellum in cooperation with the neocortex is such a heavy player in autism.
Speaking about autism, in the chapter of the book which is dedicated to this topic, at the very beginning you describe that we talk about autism as one phenomenon, but it's actually unclear whether it's one thing or connection of various phenomena, and that's what also makes it difficult to categorize it. Can you talk a bit more about that, perhaps? Because I just observed that you also use multiple different terms for.
Yeah. So that makes it really difficult to start with autism. Is now characterized as a spectrum of disorders, and at a higher level beyond autism, it's also overlapping with other brain developmental disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety disorders, and so on and so forth. A lot of them are overlapping in symptomatology. And within autism, there's many different genetic causes and non-genetic causes for that. And all of them and individuals with autism have very different expressions of these aberrations from these neurodiverse aberrations from the norm, if you want to say whatever that is. And of course, there is no defined norm, but because there are so many different horses and many of them are not really defined, almost every individual with autism is having his or her own disease in some way. That is also because even if you have one genetic cause for it, it folds then together in a genomic landscape that is individual. And all these regulatory processes in this genomic landscape will be affected individually. So, of course, we have common themes. So in a minority of cases, and not in the autism spectrum, and those are more that are reaching the general public audience, in the media and movies and so on and so forth, you see autistic people that have higher IQs and are specialized in a certain function, right? And are not really good at other functions. But that is only a small subgroup. Actually, the majority of autistic individuals have a very, very low IQ. They are speech impaired quite often, right? But that is not so well known. And that's almost hard to accept that they fall under the same description of autism. But that's because in the clinical world, it's just easier to describe them and more practical to describe them by some shared features, and that is communication, social communication, repetitive behaviors, those kind of things. Although in their brain circuits, the alterations might be very, very different. The autism now brings us back to the question, why is it so important to look at the brain and changes in the brain from the perspective of the synaptic changes, from the perspective of substrate changes, and that gets us back to almost all the topics we discussed so far, the pruning and the adult plasticity. The pruning and the development and the adult plasticity are common themes here that are important for the healthy brain, but also for the autistic brain. In so far, and that is very, very important and critical now, all of them have in common, it's not only that the adult and the developmental potentiation and depression share to a large degree the same molecular processes. They have things in common. They are experience dependent. They are dependent on activity in the network. And these large-scale changes that we described in pruning and that are so dramatically reorienting and orienting your entire circuit build-up, we know are changed in autism. And that is important now. And that seems to go beyond certain types of very specific types of autism. So in autism generally, regardless of very specific subtypes, pruning is affected. So we only know a few shared common themes in the various types of autism, but that is one of them, that pruning is affected. In humans, we know that too, not only in animal models, that's supported by animal models, but in humans, we know that in postmortem, so after death of individuals, we know that these pruning processes are affected. And think about it, that has dramatic consequences. So that means now you have too many synapses, mostly excitatory synapses, and that has two consequences. This immediate relevance to what we know from autistic people. Number one is because it's mostly pruned excitatory, so activating synapses that are not pruned anymore. We all of a sudden have more excitatory than inhibitory synapses. So the so-called excitation to inhibition balance is disturbed. And that leads to a very, very often found, not general, but very often found symptom in autistic patients, and that is epilepsy. So more than one third of children with autism, various types of autism, have epilepsies and seizures. And that has presumably to do with this phenomenon that there is no proper pruning. And the second effect of that, so that's more like a quantitative thing, but there's also a qualitative aspect to that. The pruning is there to optimize your circuits. So that means sensory input that doesn't meaningfully connect to your specialized circuits and doesn't really make sense or so, is normally pruned away. Now it's not. That means the filtering out of meaningful information is not there to a proper degree anymore. That means you are bombarded with non-meaningful information in the autistic brain. And that might explain some of the problems that we see too, filtering out meaningful information. It also has to do with this effect that autistic children report, this intense world syndrome that has been described, that they feel there's too much all the time, too much sensory information. It doesn't make sense. It's overwhelming. It's just too much. And that has to do with both effects. There's just too much excitation. It's not the right excitation, right? And so that shows like how big of an effect presumably this this pruning effect has. And secondly, we know also, and that is not from human studies, but from the animal model studies that we have, that the adult plasticity processes, long-term potentiation and depression are affected in mouse models for autism. That is true in humans too, and there's no reason to believe that it's not. Then that would mean also the ability to adapt is not working quite right. The whole up and down regulation of synapses adjustment over time is not working right. I'll give you an example. We have just published a study last year in a journal called Biological Psychiatry. In the cerebellum, and that brings the cerebellum back, where we show in recordings from awake mice in a certain type of autism. And we show that this climbing fiber, this arrow signal that I mentioned before, that gives errors, an arrow signal when something in your sensory motor world is going wrong that forces you to adapt things. They send signals to these Purkinje cells in the cerebellum, and they are activating both the climbing fiber and the Purkinje cell are activated with sensory information of all different kinds. Auditory, visual, texture, everything. And we found with imaging studies in the awake animal that these signals are way too big. They're way too large. And that could be related. That's a big jump to make, but it's the only case that is known so far in the literature where we can link it to this too strong response in the brain to sensory stimuli, like a normal sensory stimulus that normally should be completely neutral now leads to this way exaggerated signal in a fiber system and in the brain area that is warning you if something is going wrong in your sensory motor world, right? And that is because it's upregulated. It has to do with synaptic connectivity, but there's also a lack of plasticity to adjust it right now, right, and in a proper way. And that shows how, of course, our discussion of the cerebellum was not in the book. It's easier to follow that up now in our podcast here. It's difficult to follow all the details there. Of course, it's a very complicated, non-intuitive brain structure. And the neocortex is always way more intuitive because you can say, like, more is always better. You have a potentiation of synapses. You can easily imagine there's more connectivity. It's kind of beneficial in some way, unless you get epilepsy. But the cerebellum and those brain structures remain a little bit elusive, but they're really good diagrams and everything in the book. But just take this away. These plasticity problems, pruning the plasticity problems in the healthy brain and then also in autism extend in all these brain areas. The same motif of brain adaptability and plasticity and how it is important in the healthy brain and how it goes wrong in the affected brain holds true. Because it's partially a genetic process, so all cells in the body are affected in the nervous system, the effect then carries out and has an impact on what is happening. And you find that in these different systems, right? And it's worth looking not only at the neocortical structures, which are primarily or more directly cognitively related, but then also at the supporting brain areas that might be more directly linked to those impacted situations or disease situations than previously realized. And that's a really big thing now in research and in clinical context too, to look at beyond. You look at the underbelly now to fully understand what's going on, and that gives us maybe a better key in brain developmental disorders in general.
That actually leads to the next question. What kind of current trends and current open questions do you find the most fascinating?
Yeah, that's a very, very good one. I think in neuroscience, understanding the brain in general, we will see in the future a much bigger emphasis on passing this bridge to clinical applications, to psychiatry. So psychiatry as a clinical field is kind of medieval at this moment, right? It's medieval. It's very backwards in a sense that, and this is nobody's fault, but we don't have the understanding really, right? Because psychiatry works with therapy techniques, with drugs that nobody really understands exactly how they are working. I mean, they know, of course, technically what they do, but not exactly how they affect the circuit so that the improvement that is observed is taking place. That is not understood. And deep brain stimulation, all those things that are also not understood how they really work. And that is why I'm saying medieval. And we have to understand how these disorders arise, how these malfunctions arise, what is happening there, to then understand how the treatments, the effective treatments that we have, work, because only then we can get much more specific with them. We can get much better treatments if you really understand what's going on. I think that will be one of the big things and trends that is happening. Another one is we have to make steps from animal model physiology more, that can't be exclusively, but more towards human cellular physiology too. We know so little about how human neurons behave at the single cell or small circuit level. We all know almost nothing. We assume it's very similar to what our animal models do. But the more we have these very few studies coming in, the more we realize there are actually, yeah, similarities, but there are also important differences. And we have to do more. We have to do more of that and understand human physiology better. And that will then hopefully lead to better therapies and individualized therapies too.
Thank you. I think this has been a very insightful discussion, and it's a great and positive closure for it. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rika.